continuing to look, of course, at the life of Christ, and we're in this section now between, we've passed the third Passover, and so we're headed now toward the fourth Passover, which will be the time that Jesus is executed on the Roman cross. And so this section from the third Passover to the arrival at Bethany, and the first part of it has to do mainly with Galilee again, Jesus making these trips in and out of Galilee. But what we've seen thus far as we've been looking at this section is that it seems to be a series of interruptions. 2 weeks ago, we looked at this, the Pharisees and the scribes, some of them come from the Roman or the Jewish leadership in Jerusalem after this third Passover, and they come up to Galilee where Jesus is working. They accuse his disciples of not following the traditions of the elders, and so they interrupted the preaching and teaching that he was doing, and he used that interruption as an opportunity to teach, as a beneficial interlude, as we've been calling it. And then last week he left Galilee and he went up to Tyre, which is, as far as we know, the first time that he left Israel's soil, so to speak. And there we have another interruption. Jesus was hoping to spend some time alone with his apostles. He didn't really want it to even be known that he was there, but people find out, as they always did. And so you have this the Syrophoenician woman that has a daughter that is demon-possessed, and the interaction that they have. And so again, he turns an interruption into an opportunity to teach. And we'll see that pattern as we continue on. But of course, we left last week then with him at Tyre. And so as we begin this week, again, he's continuing to avoid Herod's territory. Remember, after the beheading of John the Baptist, Herod has kind of turned his attention on Jesus and the apostles and what they're doing. And so Matthew 15:29, Mark 7:31 talk about this particular section, not in great detail, but Matthew 15:29 that was read for us a moment ago, Jesus departed from there, that would be Tyre where he was at, skirted the Sea of Galilee and went up on the mountain and sat down there. Mark 7:31 says again, departing from the region of Tyre and Sidon, he came through the midst of the region of Decapolis to the Sea of Galilee. And so Jesus' cover had been blown, so to speak, in the area of Tyre. As this woman found out, and no doubt if she found out he was there, there were others that found out he was there as well. And so as they leave Tyre, they don't go back immediately to Galilee. In fact, they're going to kind of take the long way around, so to speak, so that they don't go through Galilee. He's still avoiding Herod's territory, it seems, and so they moved north to Sidon. That's an area of about 20 miles, and then they go east, it would seem, across the mountains and the headwaters of the Jordan River, and then they turn south and they come down the east side of the Jordan River and the east side of the Sea of Galilee through the tetrarchy of Herod Philip, until they reach a desolated spot in the region of Decapolis. And so if we look at a map again, and I hope you can see that, it's mainly just kind of black and white. I tried with my great drawing skills to put some things on here to help, but Jesus is here at Tyre. And so they go north, again, about 20 miles. They're, as they go from Tyre, which is mainly Gentile, but there's some Jewish people that live there, as they go that 20 miles north, they're going to go into an area that's pretty much purely Gentile. And so they're getting further away from Israel and where the Jewish people live. And so they turn again, they go over and cross the Jordan River and down. They're going to go down into this same general area of Gadara, where remember they'd gone to the region of the Gadarenes before, where they run into these demonic men that are out among the tombs and so forth. It seems they're in the same general region. And so here's Decapolis, and I tried to outline it here in the red. It has a border kind of like Texas, nice straight lines on it. But Decapolis is down here is the name, but it goes all the way up the Sea of Galilee. If you can't see it, it's right there. And so it goes all the way up and touches borders partly on the Sea of Galilee. And so Sidon, again, a Gentile territory, but Decapolis is also Gentile territory. And so he's no longer among his own people. He's no longer among the Jews. Decapolis literally means 10 cities. Deca means 10. Polis is the Greek word for city. And so 10 cities. What 10 cities? Well, the specific list of the 10 cities associated with the name varies depending on the author that you look at and the date that you're looking at. But it was an area that was dominated by Greek culture and Greek religion. And so again, he's outside now of the stronghold of the Jews and a Jewish way of doing things and so forth. Some harmonies call this the second withdrawal from Galilee. And some refer to it as the third withdrawal from Galilee, in spite of the fact that they don't go back through Galilee on the way here, and thus it's not really a withdrawal, but that's the number is not really all that important. It's sufficient to know that during this period, again, he's avoiding Herod's territory. And so from this point on, he's going to be going into Galilee and withdrawing from Galilee on a pretty regular basis. We could title the next couple of events that we'll be looking at this evening, More of the Same. Because there's really not a lot of new things here. Neither the healings nor the feeding of the 4,000 present anything new. We've seen Jesus healing. We've already seen the 5,000 fed earlier, and we looked at that again this morning, looking at it from a little bit different perspective. But what is new and what is unique here is that this is done for Gentiles in Gentile territory. And so that makes it actually quite a bit different than what we've been looking at. You know, as we observe the ebb and flow of Jesus' ministry at this point, we notice a consistent theme of a Gentile inclusion. He's gone up to Tyre, and this Syro-Phoenician, again, she was from Phoenicia. She was a Syro coming from Phoenicia, was a part of the greater region of Syria. She was Greek in her culture. You know, she's kind of a mixed bag, but she certainly was a Gentile. And, you know, we talked last week, don't want to rehash it, about, you know, this discussion going back and forth they have. He calls her a little dog and so forth. But these specific events need to be interpreted in the light of that theme that Jesus is now reaching out to the Gentiles. We can't correctly understand what Jesus is doing without understanding where he's going. You know, that it's important. I know lots of people don't like to study that deep, but it's important to understand, just as it is in any type of reading that we're doing. You know, understand who's talking, who's being talked to, where are they at, what's going on. All of those things are important in helping to understand the story. And so we need to understand that Jesus is in this Gentile area, and he's working with the Gentile people. And so a couple of things we want to look at this evening then. First of all, we see these healings in Decapolis. Matthew 15, 30 and 31, Luke 7, 32 through 37. And so if you look at Matthew's account, again, that Ryan read for us a few moments ago, verse 30 and 31, then great multitudes came to him, having with them the lame, blind, mute, maimed, and many others. And they laid them down at Jesus' feet, and he healed them. So the multitude marveled when they saw the mute speaking, the maimed made whole, the lame walking, the blind seeing, and they glorified the God of Israel. Notice the variety of different maladies, illnesses, deformities, whatever, that are being brought to Jesus. And you can see how they marvel. The mute is now speaking. The maimed made whole. There's some debate exactly what that word maimed means, but it seems that maybe the Living Bible, actually in their paraphrase of it, hit pretty close to what it meant, that those that didn't have arms and legs now have arms and legs. You know, think of how amazing that would be. You know, and so you have the maimed, they're made whole. They weren't whole before, but now they're whole. The lame, the guy that couldn't walk, he's now walking. The blind are seeing. And so certainly they marvel. But as we look again at what's going on, as the Lord reaches his destination, he climbs up onto the side of the mountain and he sets down, according to verse 29. And he does that, no doubt, to teach his disciples. Setting was the position of teaching in those days. And very, very similar to what we see him doing in the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, verses 1 and 2. And once more, he's interrupted. Then great multitudes came to him, having with them the lame, blind, maimed, many others, and they laid them down at Jesus' feet. So he goes up. It seems he's trying to get some private time with his apostles, but you know it's just not happening because you have all of these multitudes. When it says that they laid them down at Jesus' feet, the Greek literally says that they cast them down. And if you look, that's the way it's translated in the King James and the American Standard. And that's actually a very accurate translation. They cast them down. Now, we shouldn't suppose from that they meant to mistreat them in some way. But it does indicate the haste and the concern that they have as they're bringing these people to Jesus. And they're casting them down before him. Again, this is the same general area that Jesus had been before when he had healed the two demonics in the country of the Gadarenes. Again, if you look at your map, I know you can't see that, but there's Gadara right there. There's the Sea of Galilee again. And so that's where he had come whenever he and the apostles came across, and they had, Mark or Matthew, I forgot, one of them says one man, the other says two, but it focuses on the one man, and Jesus cast out this legion of demons, and they go into the pigs, and the pigs run into the sea, and so forth. And so he's in the same area, and of course, when we think back at that occasion, which is in Mark chapter 5, Jesus was asked at the end of that story to leave that country. Jesus had instructed one of those healed men, though, the one that the story focuses on. Remember, he had wanted to go with Jesus. He had wanted to get in the boat when Jesus is leaving, and Jesus tells him to stay there, but he tells him to share how the Lord had showed mercy to him. Mark chapter 5 and verse 19. You go and you tell your story. And the text says that immediately the man began to proclaim in Decapolis all that Jesus had done for him. And everyone who heard him had marveled. That's Mark 5 and verse 20. And so the effectiveness of this man's message is seen in the thousands that we have coming out to Jesus now here in Mark chapter 8. This man had evidently been pretty effective in telling his story. And so now all of these people are coming out seeking from all over the region, they're coming out seeking help from Jesus. Earlier, the men of the region had said, get out. And now they're begging, help us. Help us. So their attitude has changed about Jesus. If Jesus became frustrated at these continual interruptions, he doesn't show it. You know, there had to be, you know, maybe a little bit of frustration, and then again there's a need to spend time with his apostles preparing them, but certainly he doesn't show that frustration. But he turned the interruption into an opportunity to point the hearts of a largely Gentile audience to the true and living God. As Gentiles, these people were pagans. They would have served the pagan gods, not the true God. And so it's an opportunity to point them toward the true God. This crowd has a different composition than the previous crowd on the east side of the sea, the 5,000 that he fed that we looked at this morning. That crowd had followed him from Capernaum. And they were a largely Jewish crowd. But this crowd comes from this region, from Decapolis, and so they would be primarily Gentile. And so the multitude marveled again when they saw the mute speaking, the maimed made whole, the lame walking, the blind seeing, and they glorified the God of Israel. Notice who they glorify. Again, these are pagan people, but they're not glorifying their gods. They're glorifying the God of Israel, because it's one representing the God of Israel who is there doing these things for them. Go over to Mark's account, Mark 7, beginning verse 32. And Mark is going to kind of focus in on the healing of one individual here. It says, "Then they brought to him one who was deaf and had an impediment of his speech, and they begged him to put his hand on him. And he took him aside from the multitude and put his fingers in his ears, and he spat and touched his tongue. Then looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, Ephphatha, that is, be opened. Immediately his ears were opened, and the impediment of his tongue was loosed, and he spoke plainly." So Mark records this one specific incident. You have all of these people being healed, but Mark focuses on this one, this healing of the one who was deaf and had an impediment of speech. Apparently, this man's difficulty in speaking is not merely because he was deaf. Now, deaf people have a very difficult time learning to speak. I remember as a kid, there was a family lived a couple of miles from us back on a farm, and they had a brother named Barney Hale. And he was, people said he was deaf and dumb. And dumb not meaning he was unintelligent, but he was deaf and mute. He was deaf, and thus he had never learned to speak because he couldn't hear people speak. And so he could make some sounds. I remember being around him as a kid. He could make some sounds, but he couldn't do anything that was intelligible. And so this doesn't seem to be that. There seems to be more to it than that. Because Mark 7:35 says that he had an impediment of his tongue, and when it's healed, that impediment of his tongue is loosed. And so evidently there's something about the formation of the tongue and the mouth that was keeping him from being able to speak properly. You know, it says that Jesus took him aside. The crowd is there, but Jesus takes this man aside, and he put his fingers in his ears, and he spat and touched his tongue. You know, why did Jesus put his fingers in this man's ears? That wasn't something we normally see Jesus doing. Well, why did he spit and touch the man's tongue? And the truth is, I don't know. It doesn't tell us. You know, maybe the simplest explanation that I saw, and the one that makes more sense, is maybe Jesus, you have a deaf man, and maybe Jesus was just trying to show the man what he was going to do. You know, when you're trying to speak to somebody that can't hear, or somebody that speaks a different language than you, you can get pretty inventive in how you try to get your information across, can't you? I know Cindy says there's a guy that cooks sometime at Underwood's that doesn't speak English, and so when she needs two fish, she goes two, and he knows what she's talking about. And maybe it's just as simple as Jesus was saying, I'm gonna heal your ears, and I'm gonna heal your tongue. I don't know why he did that. I don't know why he spit. Maybe he just needed to spit at that point. I don't know. But the new American Standard translation actually adds some words there. It says he touched his tongue with his saliva, but that's not an accurate translation. There's nothing in the text that says what, if anything, Jesus did with the saliva. But, you know, again, these actions are actions that our curiosity wants to know why he did these things, but they're not things that we see repeated with other healings. And so we have to assume that they were really incidental to the healing that Jesus did. And so not, and again, we're not told the details, and so we don't surmise on that. But what seems to be of more significance is that Jesus looked up to heaven, he sighed and said. So as he heals, he looks up to heaven and he sighed. I think maybe that sigh is significant. It lets us know that the Lord did not heal mechanically. He didn't heal without feeling. That Jesus' heart is involved in these things. We've seen so many times Jesus looking at the crowds, and especially these that are unfortunate in some way, and he looks at them with compassion. We talked about this morning that we need to have that same type of compassion when we look at those around us that have needs. But his heart was touched. His heart was touched by every person who struggled with physical and or spiritual maladies. One writer said Jesus may have sighed because he thought of the millions of others who were deaf and dumb in this world who would never be able to hear and speak. They didn't have the opportunities that this man had of standing at his feet. But after Jesus said, "Be opened," and Jesus, he spoke in Aramaic, and Mark records the Aramaic word, Ephrathah, and then he translates it into Greek for us, be opened. It says the man's ears were opened, and the impediment of his tongue was loosed, and he spoke plainly. And the result we see in verse 37, that the people were astonished beyond measure, saying, "He has done all things well." And so if we look back at our text in Mark chapter 7, verses 36 and 37, then he commanded them that they should tell no one. But the more he commanded them, the more widely they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, "He has done all things well. He makes both the deaf to hear and the mute to speak." You know, again, earlier when Jesus was in this region, he had told this healed demonic, he had told him to go and tell everyone in the area what had happened to him. Mark 5:19. And it seems again from the results we're seeing here that he had done just that. But this time he commanded them that they should tell no one. Why the change? The change seems to be because Jesus' purpose has changed. He now needs to spend this time with his disciples. He's getting into that last year of preparation time that he has with the disciples, the apostles, to prepare them for his going away. And so he needs that precious time with them. But as usual, we see that his request is not heeded. But they go out and they spread his fame throughout the region. The more he commanded them to be quiet, the more widely they proclaimed it. Mark uses an interesting word here in this text. It's a Greek word. It's the word that's translated, one Greek word that's translated with six English words in our New King James Version. It's the phrase "had an impediment in his speech." The NIV just shorter says that he could hardly speak. But it's a Greek word, megalalos, and it's only used as one time in the New Testament. And in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, it's also used only once. And that's in Isaiah 35 and verse 6. And that passage in Isaiah is clearly a messianic text. And listen to it and see how it ties with what's going on here. Isaiah 35, beginning in verse 5, "Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the dumb," that's the New King James rendering there in Isaiah, and of course they're translating that from the Hebrew text, not from the Septuagint, the Greek. It says, the dumb sing, and the waters shall burst forth in the wilderness, and so on. A better translation than the dumb would be a stammerer. of the Hebrew text. But again, the Septuagint uses that same word that Mark chooses to use here in the New Testament. And it seems that he's probably pointing back, by the use of that word, that he's pointing back to and drawing attention to this messianic prophecy about Jesus. Remember, the disciples, even Jesus himself, probably used to a great extent the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the scriptures. And so that's what they were actually more familiar with than the actual Hebrew text. But Mark ties this back through that word to this prophecy about healing, a prophecy about the blind, their eyes being opened, the ears of the deaf unstopped, the lame leaping like a deer, the dumb or the stammerer being able to, doesn't say to speak, but even to sing. So interesting. And more interesting in that Mark relates it here to Jesus' dealing, not with Jews, but with a Gentile. When Jesus left that area, he left people whose hearts were ready to receive the gospel. Gentile people whose hearts were ready to receive the gospel. And so when the church was scattered from Jerusalem in Acts chapter 8, the persecution led by Saul of Tarsus, later to become Paul, as that persecution came and the Christians were scattered throughout Judea and Samaria and all of that region, ultimately to the uttermost parts of the world, as Jesus had predicted in Acts 1 and verse 8. But as they went throughout that area of Palestine, the hearts of many were receptive because of this earlier work that had been done. Work that really went back all the way to the work of John the Baptist. And then Jesus and the apostles. The seed had been planted and it's been there growing in these hearts. And now when it's time for the inclusion of the Gentiles, they are ready. If we react in the right way to interruption, as we see the Lord doing continually, it may open a door to teach the gospel to those who interrupt us. And that's what we see here. Well, the second thing we want to look at, we're not going to look at it in great depth because there's a lot of similarities between it and the feeding of the 5,000, but the feeding of the 4,000. And we're going to mainly point out the differences that we see. But in Mark chapter 8, verse 1, continuation, there's a chapter break there, but it's a continuation of the story. It says, in those days, the multitude, being very great and having nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said to them, I have compassion on the multitude, because they have now continued with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their own houses, they will faint on the way, for some of them have come from afar. Jesus' fame, it spreads quickly through the Decapolis. And so it's the same occasion. He's still there. He's teaching. He's been there for 3 days now. And as he's there in that same location, the numbers continue to grow until there's a great multitude. It's very great. And Matthew 15:38 says about 4,000 men besides women and children. So we saw in the earlier text 5,000 men besides women and children. Here we have 4,000 men besides women and children. And so the question again is, how many women and children that were there? And we don't know, but estimated maybe somewhere between 8,000 to 12,000 total when you add the women and children in. And Jesus says that some of them have come from afar. And so they're not from the immediate area, even though he says, you know, if they go to their homes, but some of them's homes are a good ways off, and so they might faint on the way. And so once again, we see Jesus as he's gracious when he's interrupted, even when he's interrupted for 3 days. And, you know, we're not given the details of those 3 days. We would assume that Jesus had continued to teach and heal just as he did on the first day. But unlike those who had earlier followed Jesus from Capernaum, those in this crowd would have come prepared with provisions. They're local people, and they're going out to Jesus, but they probably only planned on maybe going for the day. And so they've brought their provisions, but now after 3 days, they've run out. But they don't want to leave. And so they're still there, and they're hungry. And so the nature of the interruption changes. The multitude desperately needs food. So let's look at Mark, picking back up in verse 4, Mark 8, beginning verse 4. Then his disciples answered him, "How can one satisfy these people with bread here in the wilderness?" And he asked them, "How many loaves do you have?" And they said, 7. So he commanded the multitude to sit down on the ground, and he took the 7 loaves and gave thanks, broke them, and gave them to his disciples to set before them, and they set them before the multitude. They also had a few small fish, and having blessed them, he said to set them also before them. So they ate and were filled, and they took up 7 large baskets of leftover fragments. Now those who had eaten were about 4,000, and he sent them away. And so the Lord is again, he's turning this bothersome interruption into a beneficial interlude. To reinforce his earlier lesson of the 5,000, he first presented the problem to the disciples. And they, in essence, said, "We have no idea how to handle this dilemma." Notice again their response there in verse 4. The disciples answered him, "How can one satisfy these people with bread here in the wilderness?" And, you know, we kind of look at that and say, well, how dense can you get? You just had the feeding of the 5,000. You know, don't you know what Jesus can do? And so scholars find it difficult to believe that the apostles could have so quickly forgotten the feeding of the 5,000, and so that's caused some to conclude that the account of the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000 are actually references to the same event. That somehow it gets recorded twice, but that there's no justification for that conclusion. And so we're going to say to the answer to that is no. These are two separate events. You know, and there are several reasons why we would say that. First of all, Matthew and Mark both record both of these events. They record them as two separate events. And you're talking about people who, in Matthew's case at least, is an eyewitness. He was there both times. He was one of the apostles. And so he witnessed the feeding of the 5,000. He later witnesses the feeding of the 4,000. Mark, of course, was not an eyewitness, but he did have eyewitness testimony, that of Peter. And so that would have been certainly valid as well. Also, Jesus later referred to both events. He admonishes his disciples in Matthew 16, verses 9 and 10, and he says, "Do you not yet understand or remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000 and how many baskets you took up? Nor the loaves of the 4,000 and how many large baskets you took up?" Jesus references it as two separate events. Same thing in Mark's account, Mark 8, verses 19 and 20. And so, although there are similarities, and certainly there are many similarities between the two events, but there are also a lot of differences. The place is different. The first miraculous feeding was at the north end of the Sea of Galilee. The second one is at the south end of the Sea of Galilee. The crowd is different. The first crowd was largely Jewish. The second is largely Gentile. The size of the crowd is different. You have 5,000 men in the first account and 4,000 men in the second. The time involved is different. In the first account, it's day one. It's the first day that they've been together. Jesus and the apostles have gone across on a boat. The other people have ran around. And so it's the first day. In the second event, it's the third day that this takes place. The reason for the need for food is different. The first group, they had not brought food. Jesus and the apostles hadn't brought food. They left Capernaum quickly. The people left in a hurry following Jesus. Nobody brought food. The second crowd had brought food, but they've stayed longer than they had food, and so they've run out. The available resources are different. The 5,000, you have 5 loaves and 2 fish. In the feeding of the 4,000, you have 7 loaves and a few fish, however many that was. The tools used are different. In the feeding of the 5,000, you have 12 small baskets that are gathered up. In the second account, you have 7 large baskets. And that small basket, large basket, that's based on a different Greek word for basket being used in the two occasions. The word that's used in the 5,000 is a smaller basket. People would carry a basket kind of like we would carry a purse or a wallet or something today. It was something that they, you carried the stuff you needed as you left the house. And so these were small baskets. The word that's used here in the second account is a word for large baskets, baskets that were sometimes even large enough to hold a man. Baskets like would have been used in 2 Corinthians 11:22 whenever they let Paul down over the wall of Damascus in a basket. That's the type of baskets we're talking about. So the 7 baskets of leftovers in this second account is much greater quantity than the 12 baskets that we read about in the first account, because the baskets are different sizes. There are other differences as well. The first crowd sat on the grass, the second sat on the ground. The first crowd tried to make Jesus king after he fed them. There's no similar response from the second crowd. And so anybody that believes the Bible is inspired, that it is indeed the Word of God, must conclude that these are indeed two separate incidences, two separate events. That Jesus had fed 5,000 men plus the women and children up by Capernaum. Now he feeds 4,000 Gentiles down in Decapolis. And so the question remains, though: how can we explain then the apostles' response? How do they, after the feeding of the 5,000, still not have a clue how Jesus is going to take care of this similar problem not that much long later in time that they have? Well, there are several things to think about. One is that it generally took more than one time for the apostles to grasp a new truth. We see the apostles struggling with a lot of things, don't we, that Jesus repeated on a fairly regular basis. Brother J.W. McGarvey wrote that the failure to expect a miracle, despite previous experience, was a common occurrence in the history of Israel and the 12. And he notes passages in the Old Testament like Numbers 11, 21 through 23, and Psalm 78, 19 through 20. We could also say it's a pretty common occurrence for us as well, couldn't it? How many of us get it the first time? Not many. I'm sure a lot of y'all are a lot smarter than me and get it before I would, but it usually takes some repetition before it gets through our old thick heads. And consider the fact that hunger was was a common problem. Jesus and the apostles, the people that they ran into, and as a general rule, Jesus did not alleviate hunger with a miracle. And so we look at these two accounts and we say, they ought to have known. Well, how many similar times had they had whenever there's multitudes are following Jesus everywhere? And how many times had they been in similar circumstances where Jesus did not perform a miracle to heal them? And then lastly, the 12 could have taken Jesus's rebuke that he does in John 6, 26 and 27. He says there, speaking to the crowd, and this is after the feeding of the 5,000, he says, "Most assuredly I say to you, you seek me not because you saw the signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled. Do not labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life, which the Son of Man will give you, because God the Father has set his seal on him. So he chastises the people because they were just wanting to be there because he would feed them. You know, they've come back a second day on that occasion, and they're wanting him to feed them again. He'd fed them the day before, and they think they've found the gravy train here. He's saying your focus is wrong. And so they might have taken that strong rebuke as an indication that Jesus is not going to perform such a miracle again. But taking all those factors into consideration, their response, you know, isn't as strange maybe as it first appears. The truth be told, an honest look at ourselves would hardly paint a better picture. We would struggle in the same ways. We do struggle when it comes to faith that we ought to have, and the provision of Jesus, and the sustaining of us that Jesus does. You know, even though Jesus has proven time and time again in all of us' lives, our life is often an embarrassing display of unbelief, isn't it? And so we struggle. We should be able to understand why the apostles struggled with these things as well. But once again, Jesus miraculously fed the masses. And he didn't do so merely to alleviate hunger. Again, that's why we have similar incidences where, you know, he could have done the same thing, but he didn't. But that was not really the focus. The focus was on teaching the 12 the lessons that they needed to learn. Jesus didn't give up on his desire to be alone with the disciples. That was still a priority, still something that was needed. And so having fed the people, we see at the end of the text that he sent them away. And he gets into a boat and he goes from that east side, southeast side of the sea, and he's going to go over to the west side of the Sea of Galilee. He's going to try again to get some private time with his apostles. There's going to be more interruptions, and there's going to be more interruptions that Jesus turns into beneficial interludes. But we'll pick up with those adventures next week as we continue on with the text. Lesson's yours. Is anyone here this evening who needs to respond to the Lord's invitation? If you would come as we stand and sing.